You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There are many accepted truths and unwritten laws in sports believed by fans, players, and coaches alike. Things like home field advantage and players being on a roll are accepted as sports wisdom, and we assume the numbers support them. University of Chicago professor Tobias Moskowitz and L. John Wertheim, a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, test some of those assumptions, comparing them to the raw data, in their book, Scorecasting, The Hidden Influences Behind How Sports Games Are Played and Won. It's published by Crown, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hello.
Hello.
You studied years of sporting events and thousands upon thousands of games. This must have been a monumental task. I hope you got some help.
I had hired a number of undergrads to help me comb the data, comb the internet, and find data. And with sports, as you might imagine, they were pleased to do it. Many of them said, oh, we'll do this for free. We do this anyway. So I certainly had some help.
And is this something you've also done at Sports Illustrated, John?
You know, a little bit. And a little bit of it was just sort of, you know, we've known each other for most of our lives. We've pictures at each other's bar mitzvahs, and we're just sort of talking about this and realizing, you know, the data is really not all that hard to come by. People have these accepted truths and this sort of conventional wisdom that's petrified into, you know, we just take these sports cliches as articles of faith, and the data actually not all that hard to come by. It just has never really been taken to the test like this.
Well, you've been friends for years, but can I trust the two of you? You're both Cubs fans, aren't you? What does the data tell us about why the Cubs? Is it really a curse?
Well, no. They certainly have been futile. Unfortunately, we are Cubs fans, but the big issue we find is incentives. We wanted to look at this as lifelong Cubs fans. We certainly didn't believe there's a curse, but let's put it to the test.
Well, let's look at some of the truisms. First of all, why do you think they come about? Aren't they based on some amount of fact? For example, defense wins championships. Most of the teams that were in the playoffs, in the NFL playoffs, had very strong defenses, didn't they?
Well, they also had very strong offenses, and if they had both, it was better. But we don't think you don't need to motivate Kia starting at a very young age. You know, Michael Jordan said defense wins championships, but you know, so does the coach of my son's 7-year-old team.
And Michael Jordan's shot went in a lot more than other players.
Yeah, exactly. That's so right. So what did he need to do? He needed the offense. I'll take care of that. I need to motivate my teammates to play defense. And that's what's happened throughout sports. So that's another example of something that's sort of hardened into wisdom, but really not a lot of empirical backing.
And you raise a good point, which is a lot of the things that we look at, we want to understand not just whether these statements are true, but why they exist. So if defense isn't the only thing that wins championships, why do people utter it? And I think it's because of incentives to motivate people. You don't get glory from playing defense, right? Offense is easy. It's the reason that fans chant defense, defense, and not offense, offense.
So. But nobody seems to in the business seems to say that. I haven't heard any color commentators say, well, you know, that's not actually true. Let's look at the numbers.
I think people just haven't looked at the numbers. I would love to see the numbers that people use to back up that statement, and I couldn't come across any. So we ran the numbers ourselves, and we just didn't find any evidence of it.
Well, let's look at home field advantage. Now, teams' records indicate that that's true, don't they?
Unquestionably. Home field advantage exists. It exists throughout time and literally for decades and decades and decades. It's remarkably consistent among sports that the home field advantage and a Central American soccer league is almost identical as a European soccer league. WNBA percentage, same as NBA. No question that the home team wins the majority of the games. The question we then looked at is why.
Well, I would say the players know the arena or the field. They have the support of the crowd. They slept in their own beds before the game.
Yeah, we that was where we started as well. It turns out that those things don't seem to have much impact. And one thing I'll say, let me start with sort of sleeping in your own bed and traveling. One thing we looked at was same city games. So when the Giants play the Jets, when the Islanders play the Rangers, the home field advantage is the same as it always is, whether the team slept in their own beds the night before and didn't travel versus whether they came from 3,000 miles away. So it doesn't seem like travel explains it.
So what is it? You conclude that even in college basketball where fans like Duke's Cameron Crazies paint their faces and stand yelling and jumping for entire games, that the crowds have little impact on
our other instinct was, sure, if there were 20,000 people outside the studio booing you, you'd probably have a worse show than if they were saying Lenny, Lenny. It turns out we looked at the data and we really didn't find much evidence that athletes perform better or worse on the road.
There is the crowd noise problem, isn't there?
Well, there is, but, you know, again, we think it has somewhat of a small effect. I mean, one thing we looked at were NFL quarterbacks. So people always say the crowd noise disrupts the offense.
The team can't hear them.
That's right. But it turns out QB ratings on the road are actually higher than they are at home. I would not have expected that, but it turns out to be true. So it doesn't seem to have much of an effect. If that's
Do you have any explanation for this?
Here, I mean, after, you know, literally process of elimination, what we came up with and where the data really sings is that the officials call the game differently. Home team versus road team have a different strike zone. They're whistled for different calls in basketball.
So there is a home team advantage in when it comes to officiating.
Unquestionably. And we think that's really where this home team advantage, where that resides. The officiating is just different, and it's true across sports.
And why are the officials more likely to decide for the home team?
Well, basically, you said, does the crowd have an effect? It does have an effect, but not on the players, on the officials. Really, what it comes down to is something psychologists call social influence. And what human beings tend to do is they tend to want to be accepted by the crowd, and also their judgment tends to be influenced by the crowd. And I think when you've got tens of thousands of fans screaming that a play should be called one way, and the play, let's face it, this it turns out it occurs in the most ambiguous and uncertain place where the call's really tough to make. It is a judgment call. It's natural to, A, want to alleviate that pressure, and B, maybe you actually believe that that's the right call.
And the data is really fascinating, that the larger the crowd, the bigger this discrepancy, the closer the score, the bigger this discrepancy, the closer the fans are to the playing surface, the bigger the discrepancy. And again, we looked at a variety of sports, and the data was pretty unbelievable in all of them.
It's been my sense, and not based on any statistics, that when the officials call against the home team and the fans boo loudly, the next three close calls go the other way.
I think that's right. I think that's part of the effect as well. And that's somewhat to alleviate the pressure from the crowd. And also, I think they start questioning themselves. Maybe I did blow that call. Maybe I need to make things right.
Well, are players distracted at the foul line when the home team fans are waving everything they can to throw them off?
Surprisingly not. I mean, it certainly stands to reason. And, you know, the Duke is notorious for this. Obviously, they even have a guy in a Speedo behind the opposing basket who gyrates, and it makes for a great clip. But if you look at the data, there really isn't a lot of difference. We looked at it at different times in the game. We looked at it all sorts of different – and free throws are actually a good example, because that's something where you can really isolate. I mean, that's where – pretty controlled environment. There really is no difference.
But there are some things that you can control, especially in baseball. For example, you can set up a stadium according to the strengths and weaknesses of your team. You can let the grass grow tall or cut it really – fine. You can water down the run, the baselines. You could do all sorts of things like that. In Boston, I'm sure that the Green Monster has a major effect on home field advantage.
There's no question that some of that stuff must matter. And when we say that we think the explanation resides with officials, we just think that's the leading explanation. That has the biggest impact. So take the Green Monster in Fenway. Unquestionably, the home outfielder has a bigger advantage. He's used to caroms off the Green Monster. But that doesn't have a huge effect on the game, because if you think about how many balls are actually batted there, it's not that many. The official, of course, has a huge influence on the game, given how many plays the umpire is involved with. So I'm not disputing that couldn't have some effect. It just doesn't seem to have as big an effect as the officials.
You looked at something else, John. You studied 299 hitters versus 300 hitters in Major League Baseball. What were you looking for there?
Well, that was interesting, where we looked at sort of biases in rounding, that when gasoline stations sell gas, we know it's, you know, $249.9 per gallon. We buy 99-cent Cokes, you know, it's $9,999 cars. And we found that same sort of bias, that same tendency towards the round number, also applies to hitting. And, you know, this was research started, I should say, by Devin Pope, a colleague of Toby's and a friend of ours. And what we found was that there are many, many more batters that hit 300 versus 299. These sort of artificial benchmarks apply in sports as well.
And how does that happen?
Well, basically, it's totally even, the number of 299 and 300 hitters, until essentially the last game of the season, and even really the last at-bat of the season. What happens is, is that someone batting in the last game of the season, as soon as they get a hit that puts them over 300, they're invariably taken out of the game. And the ones that haven't gotten that hit yet stay in long enough to get it. So you have this very skewed effect.
And then much more likely to swing away at a bad pitch.
Absolutely.
We'll give you the most amazing stat I think I remember coming across, is that in the last at-bat of the season, a 299 hitter has never walked. Never walked once. 299 hitters, because they're just hell or high water. They're going to swing. They're going to make contact, and whatever happens, happens. But they're not going to get that walk, because obviously that doesn't count toward their average.
But you come to the conclusion that 299 hitters may be more valuable than 300 hitters.
They could be, because what we find is that the reason these guys vault for the 300 mark is that they're paid for it. That if you see in subsequent contracts, they get additional money for them. But if you look at what's actually happening, they're really no different than the 299 hitters. It's really a matter of luck whether you got that hit or not. And so you could argue that the 299 hitters are a bargain price. And that's
you're actually going to be paid less. And slightly. You could be paid less with some of the other rounding out things, like 100 RBIs, 20 wins for pitchers, 30 home runs. 30 home runs mean a lot in a contract as opposed to 29 home runs?
Surprisingly, yes. People have these benchmarks in mind, and that seems to convey value.
But you said this is not just a sports issue.
No. I mean, and that's sort of one of the themes of the book that we write about fairly frequently, that a lot of this is just athletes and managers and coaches and umpires. They're just conforming to human behavior. We do this all the time in our regular life, that a certain carat of ring, or you look at SAT scores, many more people hit that 0-0 mark than, say, the 1290, because they've set this benchmark and they'll retake the test if they get 1290. They won't retake it if they get 1300. That really this is just sort of basic human behavior. It's just being, it's being expressed on a baseball diamond.
My guests are L. John Wertheim, who is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, and Tobias Moskowitz, who is a professor at the University of Chicago. They've collaborated on a book called Scorecasting, The Hidden Influences Behind How Sports Games Are Played and Won. It's published by Crown. You wanted to add something, Toby?
Oh, I was just going to say you also see this in on Wall Street and in corporations, where people have these target earnings numbers. And it's interesting, we talk about this in the book, that firms never miss by a penny. They might make it by a penny or make it exactly, but they never miss by a penny. You have the same sort of benchmark bias.
Another conclusion that you come to is that the hot hand doesn't exist. It's just more a law of averages. But we believe in that hot hand. Oh, a player's really hot right now, seeing the ball better than he did earlier in the season when he was slumping. That's not true?
Well, one of the analogies we make in the book is you flip a coin 100 times, it might be 50-50, but it's not going to alternate. So when a 300 hitter who's only going to get a hit 3 out of 10 times happens to go 3-for-3, or conversely happens to go 0-for-4, it doesn't necessarily mean they're on a hot streak or a cold streak. It's just sort of the way probability works.
The math professors have this famous thing where they ask students to flip a coin 200 times and record every outcome and come back the next day. And they always warn, don't fake it, because I'll know. And the reason they'll know is no one will put down streaks of 6 or 7 heads in a row. But that will happen just by luck.
So that's what happens in a game. A player can't really be hot. We see a player one game in basketball, for example, just can't seem to miss the next game. None of the shots go in.
That certainly does happen.
So should we just think about it in terms of the season, or at least a month rather than a specific game?
That's right. What we found actually is if you want to predict the success of the team going forward or any individual player, your best bet is to use the largest sample you can, which is the greatest amount of data. So if you want to know, is Amari Stoudemire going to make his, next 5 shots? The best bet is what his career average for shooting is, not what he's done on his last 10 shots.
There's something called loss aversion, a loss aversion principle. What's that?
Loss aversion basically, I should let the economist answer this, but loss aversion basically says that the pleasure we get from gaining a dollar is outstripped by the pain we get from losing a dollar, that we sort of hate penalties more than we like rewards.
That's right. And you see this in almost every facet of life. In the book, we obviously talk about this when it comes to coaching, that coaches are much more worried about losing something, let's say points taken off the scoreboard or let's say their job too, as opposed to gaining something. And you see this, in the mutual fund industry, you see this in everyday life. People are much more worried about losing something than they are gaining something.
How does that apply to someone like Tiger Woods, who you write about? Are we talking about Tiger Woods when before he had all of his problems?
Yes. This was, said this was further proof that he's mortal even before. We had to do a little rewriting there.
That's right. No, it is. In fact, on the PGA and even Tiger Woods, you know, arguably the greatest golfer of all time, or certainly in the top three, what you find is that on birdie putts, golfers putt much more conservatively than they do on par putts. And the idea here is loss aversion, that there's this psychological effect of, well, gee, I better make this par putt, otherwise I lose a stroke, which would be a bogey. But on a birdie putt, I've got this gain in mind. I have some room to breathe. What's funny about it, of course, is all that matters is the total score, right? You really should get the ball in the hole in as few strokes as possible. When you talk to golfers, they recognize this. They say, yeah, it does seem kind of silly, but somehow psychologically that par putt seems more important.
And I'll give you one of our favorite examples, same principle from football. I hope this holds up. But a team has first down, first and goal at the 1 yard line, you know, 36 inches, and they score a touchdown. The other team has first and goal at the 9 yard line. Suddenly it's fourth and goal. Team A hasn't moved the ball at all. Now it's fourth and one, they're 1 inch. The other team, fourth and one, they've moved it 8 yards. Well, the team that three plays, 0 yards, they're more likely to go for it on fourth down because mentally they're prepared. It's going to be devastating if they don't get it. They had first and goal at the 1 yard line. They're more likely to go for it than the other team that got 8 yards and just needs one more, which is completely counterintuitive, but it's very consistent with loss aversion.
Well, fourth and five in the third quarter of a close game has conventional wisdom saying that most NFL teams will punt or try to kick a field goal, depending on where they are on the field. Statistically, you say this is the wrong decision.
Yes. In fact, what we find again, and I think a big explanation is loss aversion and coaches worried more about losing than winning, that if you look at the numbers, coaches don't go for it nearly enough on fourth down. Now, it's not true for every coach.
But wait a minute. Isn't trying to gain 5 yards a big gamble?
Well, not necessarily.
You can gain 4.5 yards, and that's a nice gain, and you still haven't gotten the first down, and now you're giving up the ball.
Obviously, it depends on where you are in the field, but keep in mind that the way that these numbers work is you're looking at the expected number of points you'll get from that possession. And oftentimes, coaches are much more willing to give up a bigger gain to avoid that potential loss. That's what they're really worried about. And they get grilled when they gamble and lose, even though it might be the right gamble.
But you say not all coaches abide by that.
A few coaches, and we do realize we recognize that it's the coaches with the most job security. It's the Bill Belichicks. It's the guys that have won Super Bowls are more likely to play the percentages. But it's just sort of interesting. I mean, you can quantify whether there's an optimal play to go for it or punt. And yet, you know, this is a rare industry in which the coach says, hey, I have to trust my gut or I have to trust conventional wisdom, and that's a sufficient response.
Well, they're cheered on when they went for it and it succeeded. They're called geniuses. And when it failed, how could they do something so stupid? That was the play that turned the game around. So it is a lot of weight on and a lot of pressure, isn't it?
Oh, it's a huge amount of pressure. And again, you know, there's a continuous theme in the book, which is if you try something conventional and fail, you don't get nearly the blame as if you try something unconventional and fail, even if the unconventional thing is a better thing to try. We see that throughout the book.
And so some of this goes to the ethos of sports. I mean, if it's a hedge fund, it's a different context. If the coach went on sports radio the next day and said, hey, look, I made the statistically optimal choice, that probably would not, the tomatoes would still be hurled.
But I remember at least 20 years ago when we started hearing about computers being used, especially by baseball managers. Some of them even bring their laptops into the dugout. All of that stuff was applied to how they drafted and pretty much every aspect of the game. And yet here we are all these years later. Everybody knows much of the old conventional wisdom is not true, and yet we still live by it. Why is that?
Well, again, part of it is incentives and part of it is being risk averse to doing something unconventional. And some of it is, too, I don't want to dispute the fact that gut intuition doesn't have value. Of course it has value. I think the right way to use this stuff is to say, if my gut tells me to do A and the data backs up A, well, then I ought to feel a lot better about that. When those two things disagree, maybe I want to think about it a little more. And that's sort of what we think.
Can you talk about Kevin Kelly's strategy with the Pulaski High School football team and how it's worked out for him?
Kevin Kelly is the coach of this football team in Little Rock, Arkansas. I went down there for a game, and I was warned it would be like nothing I ever saw, and it was true. He simply doesn't believe in punting, and his attitude is, I mean, to your point before, I mean, his attitude is, I would rather give the ball up running a play, at least having a chance, than just punting it away. And the punts in high school football aren't going very far. And he just does, there's no punter on the roster. I mean, you look at the roster and you say, what's missing? He just doesn't believe in punting. And his teams are phenomenally successful. And he's not, he's not a high caliber statistician, but he sort of has his cheats. He has his sheets and his sort of conversion charts. And he's absolutely dead positive that he's right in that punting, even when the opponent, keep in mind, part of the element of going on fourth down is there's this element of surprise. I mean, the opposing defense always knows what's coming. Nothing's coming. And his teams are phenomenally successful. And I think one point he makes beyond the beyond the analytics, or it changes the mentality of your team. If you know you have four plays, well, that's only 2.5 yards. If it's three plays, it's 3 1/3 yards. You need to get that 10. So it totally changes psychologically how his team performs as well.
If the game is on the line and a player is about to kick a field goal or shoot a free throw or throw a big pitch, a player coach will often call timeout to put pressure on the kicker, the shooter, the pitcher. Is this a proven strategy or just wishful thinking?
It doesn't seem to be a proven strategy. We look at the data, and keep in mind these are professional athletes. They seem to perform just as well whether timeout's called or not. And what I find interesting about it is nowadays everybody seems to call the timeout. So I always find it funny that kickers now expect you to call the timeout. It's not, I think you might actually have more surprise if you don't call the timeout, but we certainly didn't find it in the data.
You talk about Mike McCoy of the Dallas Cowboys and how he went against conventional wisdom in the NFL draft. The highest pick is not necessarily the best pick. What about number 2 or 3? They seem to turn out better, don't they?
Well, there's no question that on average, the number one pick tends to be better than the number 2 or 3 or 10th
Unless
or whatever.
Your name is Ryan Leaf.
That's right. The problem is that you also pay through the nose for the number one player. So relative to what you spend, both in terms of money as well as in terms of other draft picks, it doesn't seem to work out. And you hit the nail on the head, which is you can't tell whether you're getting Peyton Manning or Ryan Leaf. It's really tough.
And you're paying either way.
Yeah,
but
right.
Often the big stars are high draft choices. But then you have somebody like Tom Brady. Wasn't he selected in the 6th round?
Yeah, exactly. And you look at, I think you can build a mathematical. They'll basically tell you the Super Bowl champ drafts in a better position because with that last pick, they're not going to blow the bank on a rookie and they don't know how they'll perform. But imagine, to sort of loss aversion and to playing to expectation, imagine the team that gets the first pick in the draft goes up to the podium and says, you know what, the optimal play here is to just pass.
Now, black NFL coaches are doing worse than they have in the past, but you see that as a sign of progress.
No, that's right. This has a lot to do with the Rooney Rule, the progressive owner of the Steelers, Dan Rooney, who instituted the rule that when NFL teams are looking for a new coach, they must interview at least one minority candidate. And what we found was before that rule was in place, or actually Janice Madden, who's a professor at Wharton, found this.
Not related to John Madden.
Barely knew who he was.
That's right. What she found was actually that before the rule was in place, that black NFL coaches did much better than their white counterparts, suggesting that they were being held to a higher standard in order to get hired. After the Rooney Rule, their numbers drastically fell, which is actually a sign of progress. It suggests they're being hired on the same terms. It did exactly what it was designed to do.
And there are also more black coaches today, so
absolutely,
more of them are going to lose anyway. But there were a number of black coaches in the playoffs, so it's the normal mix now. You also talk about coin toss and the fact that the seemingly random act is really important. Why? I mean, do you think it's unfair?
This is for overtime in the NFL.
Yeah.
And fortunately, that's sort of painfully being amended, even though the convoluted system now, I'm not sure, is much better. But yeah, it used to be that you'd have these gladiators and they'd go out there and you have this great irony where they'd play football for an hour and they're bleeding and muddy and they're tackling each other. And then basically they'd tie after regulation and they would have this coin flip at midfield, and invariably the team that won the coin flip would win the overtime. So you have
they kick a field goal.
Exactly, exactly.
That's right.
Just one more thing. You say that the baseball's 162-game regular season is designed for teams like the Yankees to succeed.
That's absolutely right. I mean, if you think about it,
I knew there was a reason. I thought it was that they spent a lot of money.
Well, that's
that
part
doesn't
that,
hurt.
That doesn't hurt either. It's both actually. If you have two teams that play a small number of games, anything can happen. Take the NFL. There's only 16 games. It's very easy. The difference between an 8-8 team and a 10-6 team is a couple of lucky bounces. Over 162-game season, the talent's going to show through. It's just with that many games, you're going to get the best teams coming out on top, and you see that consistently year after year.
Although nobody would have predicted that the Giants would do so well last year. So there are other factors.
That's right.
I want to thank the both of you so much for being with us, Tobias Moskowitz and L. John Wertheim. Their book, Scorecasting, The Hidden Influences Behind How Sports Games Are Played and Won, published by Crown.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.